Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This is Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, August 1st, 2018. We start with the news section. Good neighbors. An exhibit at the Museum of Durham History chronicles the oldest Muslim community in North Carolina and how it changed the Bull City. West Chapel Hill Street has changed significantly since Arad Islamic Center opened its doors in 1971. Where the Islamic Center once operated a bakery and loaded up its food truck, the third in Durham, the story goes, stands the cookery, an event space and culinary incubator. Arazik's first fish market, mechanic shop, restaurant, and music venue are also gone from that stretch now home to a coffee shop, grocery store, and frozen yogurt place. The history of Arazik, the oldest Muslim community in North Carolina, is chronicled in Building Bridges Through Good Faith, an exhibit at the Museum of Durham History on view through August 11th. It's a story that hadn't been compiled before, but embodies Durham's place in African-American history and its roots in entrepreneurship, activism, and tolerance. The members of Arazik have lived their way in a way to make Durham better, and so that bridges were built between Muslims and non-Muslims, says Naomi Fista, who, as a college student involved in the civil rights movement, joined Arazik in its early days. As co-curator of the exhibit, Fista puts out a call to the community to unearth the history in their heads and their attics, and now covers two walls in the small museum. The exhibit includes the arrival of Muslims in America, the founding of Muhammad's Mosque No. 34, as Arazik was known when it was founded in the late 1950s, as a part of the Nation of Islam, and its influence on Durham and beyond. There wasn't that kind of documentation of the Muslim community in Durham, and we really wanted to let people know they've been here for a long time, and they continue to be great, contributing neighbors, says Museum Executive Director Patrick McClaw. When the mosque opened in its current space, the West End, once home to some of Durham's wealthiest families, was struggling, like other central neighborhoods, from the closure of the city's factories and the construction of the Durham Freeway. So members began a community patrol. They pestered drug dealers until the dealers reported them to the police for harassment, according to lore. A soup kitchen and cleanup squads, so thorough members says that the city didn't need to sweep the streets. While those efforts have dissipated as the neighborhood changed, Arazik still operates a weekend school, serves about 1,000 kids through a summer feeding program, and delivers meals to seniors. When the now controversial Nation of Islam split in the mid-1970s, the mosque changed its name to Arazik and transitioned to mainstream Al-Islam, which emphasizes religious study, community service, and racial tolerance. Many times when people think of Al-Islam, at least today, the first thing that comes to mind is foreign, says Imam Greg Rashad. Yet, here is a city where Islam was started by African Americans. That's a message we're trying to teach the community, that at least here in Durham, the first Muslim community was started by African Americans. And with that came business growth, economic growth, and community growth. The area was bustling with businesses, eateries, and a cultural center that hosted jazz and other live music, all run by the community from the mosque. To spur employment and healthy eating, the mosque joined the Nation of Islam's fish program, which imported whiting from Peru for distribution across the country. Men loaded their pickup trucks and raced to deliver it all before it defrosted. Relics are featured in the exhibit. Members also manufactured shea butter, memorialized in an obscure 90s rap song by Da Golden Rule, included in the exhibit, with nuts brought from Africa via another Nation of Islam program. Longtime member Roman Sharif, who drove a catering truck, recalls dishing out meals like navy bean pie, somewhere in between chess and sweet potato, and all-beef Unity Frank hot dogs with French fries inside the bun to the likes of Kool and the Gang, Chaka Khan, and Parliament Fundadelic when they visited Durham. Gil Scott-Aran and his band brought everything I had on the truck, he remembers. Photos in the exhibit show author James Baldwin outside the mosque's original Pettigrew Street location, attracted to a sign reading, "Choose for yourself, truth or hate." And Malcolm X debating local civil rights leader Floyd McKissick Sr. Not pictured are visits by legendary boxer Muhammad Ali, who reportedly dined at Al-Razik's restaurant, Shabazz, and stayed with its founding family, waking them early with his trademark banter. Those are the kind of people that came through this community as a result of a lot of the work that was going on, not just here in the Islamic community, but also as part of the whole social movement here in Durham. Al-Razak's also had the effect of spurring and strengthening Muslim communities across North Carolina. Durham was like the hub, Feast explains. People came here for classes. They came here for information to find out what's going on nationally. As of 2010, there are about 26,000 Muslims in the state, roughly half of whom live in the Triangle, according to the Association of Religion Data Archives. Al-Razak's membership has changed in recent years. Once majority African American, Friday night services are attended by people from all over the world, says Rashad. Its role in the community has also shifted, although it has continued interfaith exchanges that have brought students and congregations from other religions through its doors, and vice versa, for years. It's important, especially taking the temperature of the nation as it is right now, the fact that this exhibit demonstrates that communities like Al-Razak have existed peacefully for decades in towns just like Durham, large and small, across the U.S. Editor's note, admission to the museum is free. A closing reception will be held August 10th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. The next news article, Fixer Upper. By 2020, the Durham Housing Authority will begin redeveloping one of its downtown properties. It just didn't know which one. The city of Durham will pitch in just over $2 million to help the Durham Housing Authority plan for the redevelopment of about 50 acres of downtown property that DHA owns. The Housing Authority plans to redevelop more than 1,800 public housing units in the coming years through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's rental assistance. Intended to address a more than $50 billion backlog of repairs in public housing communities nationwide, RAD allows housing authorities to borrow money and partner with private investors. In Durham, DHA hopes to use the program to fully rebuild aging buildings that need an estimated $19 million in basic repairs, plus more substantial fixes like falling roofs and plumbing. Currently, DHA is renovating two of its neighborhoods, Maureen Road and DeMar Court. Unlike those developments, other Durham public housing neighborhoods will be torn down and rebuilt as mixed income, and in some cases, of value properties downtown, mixed-use communities. Under former DHA CEO Dallas Parks, the Housing Authority planned to renovate all of its public housing properties, like what's being done at Maureen Road and DeMar Court, which was initiated prior to the Parks' departure in 2016. Their residents have been moved into other apartments, most on-site, but not all, while their own units are being redone. However, under CEO Anthony Scott, who was hired in June of 2016, DHA plans to redevelop the rest of its public housing portfolio in phases with the aim of increasing the stock of affordable housing in Durham. This is why DHA is focusing downtown first, to leverage developer fees and other revenues from those prime locations to support redevelopment at other sites. The agency hasn't decided which of its downtown sites will see work first, but it hopes to begin construction on one in early 2020. Scott told the city council last week that the city won't be expected to pay pre-development costs for all of the agency's redevelopment plans. The $2.13 million grant also won't cover pre-development activities at all of DH downtown sites, just the first phase. Asked what it would cost for the city to cover pre-development for all of those properties, Scott said he didn't know. "We're not sure the full extent of what the future development deals will look like," he said. Downtown, the Housing Authority owns J.J. Henderson, a senior housing tower, Oldham Towers, another senior housing building, the adjacent Liberty Street townhomes, Forest Hill Heights in the Southside neighborhood, a vacant property south of NC 147 known as Fayette Place, and its headquarters on East Main Street. All told, 577 DHA residents, including many kids and seniors, live in the downtown area, but there is the potential for much greater density. Fayette Place, formerly known as the Fayetteville Street Projects, consists of about 20 acres of unused land. Forest Hill Heights is barely populated, with 55 apartments on 15 acres. Linked together, Oldham Towers and Liberty Street would total 12 acres. In surveys, three-quarters of DHA's downtown residents said they want to return to a new unit downtown post-redevelopment, which they have a right to do under federal RAD regulations. But as the Indy reported last year, many residents, particularly those downtown, with failed redevelopment efforts like urban renewal close in mind, are skeptical that the renovations will take place as planned and that they won't be displaced. As with most affordable housing projects, DHA needs low-income housing tax credits to make this happen, and it needs money to get its application together by the January deadline. The agency is hoping to secure an elusive 9% tax credit for its downtown project. Two development partners have been selected to help decide which property would make the best contender for those tax credits. According to meeting minutes for the DHA board, if none of the downtown sites are ready for a tax credit application, which Scott told board members was unlikely, the city and DHA could work together to seek tax credits for a property known as Southside 3, adjacent to the city-backed mixed-income Southside apartments and homes. The site isn't part of DHA's redevelopment plan, but the agency could locate units there, much like a future affordable development on Jackson Street, where some units will be subsidized by DHA vouchers. The money will go toward these redevelopment activities, including architecture and land planning, engineering, inspections, and environmental reports. The grant agreement stipulates that the work be done in conjunction with the city and that the city's money be used to support units affordable to households earning at or below 60% of the area median income, which is about $48,000 for a family of four. Although the council didn't vote on the grant Thursday, expected to be approved at the council's August 6th meeting, the money has been budgeted for the fiscal year 2019 housing fund. If the council does not approve the proposed redevelopment grant agreement, DHA will not be able to expand its development capacity in order to move effectively and to advance a significant development portfolio. A memo from Deputy City Manager Keith Caldwell reads, "The lack of capacity is likely to result in an inability to advance projects, which in turn could ultimately jeopardize the viability of future public housing redevelopment activities within Durham. The grant agreement stipulates that the money may also be used toward other publicly owned sites downtown. It's the second time DHA has asked for money from the city to help with RAD plans, the first being about $1.4 million to cover shortfalls when work at Marine Road and DeMar Court got off track. According to the staff memo, DHA will be coming back to the city for more money. The amount is unspecified to support the redevelopment of Laurel Oaks. Next, from the Soapboxer, might makes right. Absolute power flexes its muscles on Jones Street. If I were cynical enough to look past the blasé evisceration of democratic norms in pursuit of raw political power that took place on Jones Street last week, and is coming up again this weekend when the Republican-led General Assembly returns to indulge in his favorite hobby, overriding Governor Cooper's vetoes, I'd probably appreciate, maybe even admire, the unabashed shamelessness of what has transpired. It's bad enough that Republican leaders call a special session with almost no public notice based on, wait for it, a tweet from a private citizen. It was worse that they did so to prevent North Carolinians from having been even the foggiest idea about the 6 constitutional amendments they'll be voting on this November. And worse still were the shenanigans they pulled to help the GOP candidate for state Supreme Court, who was the victim of unintended consequences of previous Republican efforts to entrench Republican rule. To recap, in the waning days of this year's short session, Republicans voted to put 6 constitutional amendments on the ballot, an effort to gin up their base amid a difficult electoral season. Of course, the legislature didn't bother spelling out the details of what those amendments would do, instead entrusting the nitty-gritty of so-called implementing legislation to a special lame-duck legislature session held after the election. In other words, you'll get to find out what you voted on after you voted on it. 4 of these amendments purport to fix problems that don't actually exist. A voter ID amendment. Again, you won't get to know what kinds of identification are acceptable or what exceptions will be allowed until after the vote. And it targets the fever dream of widespread voter fraud. And an amendment to cap the income tax rate at 7% imagines that a future legislature will jack up taxes on rich people. And until the short session, I hadn't heard that crime victims of hunters or fishermen felt somehow shortchanged by existing state statutes. The other 2 amendments are simply power grabs designed to neuter the governor, who in the legislative view should not be either a Democrat or more than a ceremonial figure. 1 redirects the governor's power to appoint judicial vacancies to the legislature, while the other strips the governor of his role in making appointments to the elections board and other state boards. Under a state law passed just 2 years ago, those amendments go to the Constitutional Amendments Publication Commission, comprising the Secretary of State, Attorney General, and Legislative Service Officer, which is tasked with writing a short caption of each amendment for the ballot. The problem for the General Assembly is that 2 of the Commission's members, Secretary of State Elaine Marshall and Attorney General Josh Stein, are Democrats, and hence are not to be trusted. Compounding their anxiety, on July 20th, Jerry Cohen, the widely respected former director of the legislature's bill drafting division, who also happens to be a Democrat, tweeted a link to a memo he'd written suggesting captions for the 6 amendments. His captions were straightforward, like, "Voters shall provide photograph identification before voting in person," and protect right to hunt, fish, and harvest wildlife, and transfer powers of the governor to the General Assembly. But Republicans freaked out nonetheless. The next day, State Representative David Lewis, who chairs the powerful Rules Committee, demanded that the legislature convene in a special session to render the commission obsolete, claiming it was under pressure to write politicized captions. So last week, Republicans dutifully voted to make all the captions on the ballot simply say constitutional amendment. And then, because they can't help themselves, lawmakers try to clean up another of their self-inflicted messes. Last year, after a Democrat named Mike Morgan sneaked his way into the state Supreme Court, likely owing to his placement atop the 2016 ballot, the legislature made Supreme Court races partisan. Legislators later tweaked the law to ensure that this year's Democratic candidate will appear at the bottom of the ballot. Then earlier this year, Republicans eliminated judicial primaries. This became a problem when a former Democrat named Chris Anglin signed up to run as Republican in November, threatening the election of Republican incumbent Barbara Jackson and boosting Democratic challenger Anita Earls. As they've so often done when their chicanery was bitten them in the butt, Republicans once again changed the rules of the game. A new law, passed along party lines, removes party labels from those who changed party affiliation less than 90 days before the filing for office, and it would be applied retroactively. If his inevitable lawsuit fails, Anglin will appear on the ballot without party affiliation. Cooper vetoed both bills. The General Assembly will be back Saturday to override those vetoes, and has done nearly a dozen times over the last 18 months. This is what unchecked absolute power looks like, zealously and audaciously protecting its own. And the longer the Republicans retain their supermajorities, the more this uncompromising style of politics, contemptuous of norms, dismissive of rules, consumed by the preservation of power, incapable of shame, will become entrenched in our state government. No matter your partisan leanings, that's not something to look forward to. The next article, enemy of the people. The feds tried to lock me up for life for reporting on inauguration protest. This is a true story of conspiracy in Trump's America, written by Aaron Cantu. Editor's note. In January of 2017, Aaron Cantu spent a night in jail with hundreds of others detained during protest on Inauguration Day in Washington, D.C. His criminal actions consisted of walking, wearing black, and being a witness to history as a freelance journalist. A few months later, federal prosecutors charged him with 8 felonies, including conspiracy to riot. After nearly 18 months, the feds dropped the charges, and Cantu, now a staff writer for the Santa Fe Reporter, is finally able to publicly reflect on the ordeal. Here follows the article. For over a year, federal prosecutors and agents have perused my digital communications, tried to hack my cell phone, and possibly collected my social media records. I'm not being paranoid. This really happened. The feds invaded my life in pursuit of their own conspiracy theory about a raucous protest in Washington, D.C. that resulted in 8 felony charges against hundreds of people, myself included. The overwhelming sense of being watched has abated some since the charges were dropped in early July, but I'm sure officials within the U.S. Attorney General's office in the District of Columbia, the local arm of Trump's Justice Department, will read every word of this essay with an eye toward anything they can use to prosecute me or the 186 people still living under a 5-year statute of limitations. A few weeks after my arrest on January the 20th of 2017, referred to as J20, I accepted some painful advice. Don't criticize the Trump administration publicly. I'd hoped that my charges would get dropped before my eventual indictment in May. The inability to speak freely on social media and in the publications I wrote for drained my confidences. I still reflexively self-censor, often deleting tweets for no real reason. Even writing this is hard. This pounding in my chest, this trembling hand and sour stomach and sweaty tunnel vision are what it feels like to have your freedom of speech curtailed by the state. I went to D.C. to report on Trump's inauguration, following a year of a bubbling anti-fascism movement, pushing back against his campaign. I currently enjoy the haven of a newspaper willing to hire lawyers to bite back. But last January 1st, I was a freelancer, using vacation days for my full-time job to go witness history. This was a completely uncharted assignment. How violent could this get? Would America jackboots try to stomp me into the streets? In the end, it didn't matter that I presented myself as a journalist on J20 or that I only carried a sandwich and a notebook while white supremacists wound up messing with me for over a year, working with authorities to prosecute and harass me. After 18 months, the actual memories of the half-hour march leading to my arrest have mixed with dreams and nightmares of the day, as well as descriptions in multiple reports. My mind's eye remembers a dark funhouse of corporate buildings and unusually wolfish Jack Skellington-like-esque riot cops hemming me into a larger group. Everything looks gray and morose. It may have rained a bit. Police relentlessly deployed sting ball grenades and pepper spray. The final tally was at least 70 grenades thrown at people blocks away from where Donald Trump was sworn in. Creaks and shatters created by objects smashing glass, including the insured windows of a Bank of America branch and a Starbucks, are more memorable than any destruction my eyes may have seen. Very, very loud police sirens, punctuated by grenade explosions and screaming, overwhelm everything else. The inappropriate and extensive use of less lethal munitions suggests the need for increased supervision of officers during mass demonstration, said a report from the Police Foundation, which evaluated the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department's conduct at the inauguration protests. Impossible to forget are the feelings throughout that march. The whole body nerve rush when I first saw the huge mass of marching people extending at least a whole city block. The panic run as the sting ball grenades burst near my feet. The euphoria of an ungovernable movement, however frightening and unpredictable, that disrupted the lawful monotony binding our unequal society together. And the shock when I checked my phone from inside the mass arrest and saw that protests in D.C. had overtaken Trump's inaugural speech as the top headline on CNN. If protesters weren't able to stop the actual inauguration, they still marred it in history. When the first six of more than 200 defendants went to trial last November, prosecutors used expressions of excitement, wonder, or awe during the march as evidence of a conspiracy to riot. "I'm blissed out," photojournalist and acquitted defendant Alex Wood announced in a live stream that day. The feds later tried to use it against him. In an unidentified indictment filed against all defendants, prosecutors also used and shouted phrases like, "What do they say to do with capitalism? On whose streets? Our streets?" They wanted to transform an adrenal pulse into a criminal agreement among co-conspirators. The thought that I might be seriously screwed first occurred to me inside the police wagon transporting us to the process. I sat cramped and bound along with nine other people in one of the half miles worth of law enforcement vehicles flashing various hues of light as it carried high priority enemies of the state. I knew then we weren't going to get off with a simple citation. I didn't expect, however, that I would be charged with 8 felonies for the act of attending and reporting on a confrontational protest, or that I would be facing a potential 80 years in prison. Months later, I not only considered my own future, but the far-reaching political implications of these cases. Why did the U.S. Attorney's Office find it appropriate to hang virtual life sentences over the heads of 214 people after an indiscriminate mass arrest? How could they have so shamelessly gleaned evidence from far-right groups like Project Veritas, a discredited organization known for making deceptive gotcha videos, as well as the paramilitary group, the Oath Keepers, and still felt they had a legitimate case? And where was the motivation, the conspiracy, to pursue these charges coming from? Mass arrests at protests have happened plenty of times across the country, including in D.C. in 2002, when hundreds at a World Bank protest were arrested. What happened new in the J-20 case was the attempt to color protesters' actions as part of a pre-planned conspiracy against strangers to cause mayhem. By wrapping up distinct actions like allegedly breaking windows, chanting, and lighting fireworks at a protest into a single conspiracy, they became one threatening antisocial act against society, apparently menacing enough to warrant decades in prison. The motive to bust a conspiracy also explains the Justice Department's initial demand last summer to review 1.3 million IP addresses of people who visited DisruptJ20.org, a website used to organize loosely affiliated protests that took place at the inauguration. Despite an outcry from the media and civil rights groups, the court eventually granted much of the prosecutor's request, yet they could find no actual conspiracy. This data vacuuming extended to the cell phones that all arrestees were carrying that day. The Metropolitan Police Department used technology from an Israeli security firm to extract information from all confiscated phones that weren't sufficiently encrypted. After one anonymous defendant's phone was raided, the defendant received an 8,000-pound page dossier containing years of personal data, including intimate emails to and from my friends and lovers through more than a decade, late-night political debates over chat apps that helped shape my values and convictions, and more. To my knowledge, the feds were never able to crack into my phone thanks to strong encryption, though they made clear that they were specifically interested in me, declaring in one motion from last October that they were undertaking additional efforts to get my data. But I was sufficiently terrified by other phishing expeditions, including subpoenas issued to Apple, Facebook, and possibly Twitter for communications between and among co-defendants. I never received a notice from any of these companies that my account had been subpoenaed. Apparently, they do not have to notify you or can be gagged from doing so. But others did, and I still treat my online presence as if it's bugged. All this reaching by the prosecution turned out to be for naught. Although Assistant U.S. Attorney Rizwan Qureshi mumbled to an unbelieving D.C. jury at the second and only other trial of defendants that there had been a conspiracy to destroy our city, it was never proven. That trial this May ended in acquittals and mistrials after the first resulted in acquittals last December. The pair of failures set the stage for the collapse of the case in its entirety, letting the few dozen remaining defendants go free. The second trial took place in D.C. Superior Court, where in another room, a chief judge determined that Assistant U.S. Attorney Jennifer Kirchhoff had intentionally misled the court about the existence of nearly 70 videos recorded by Project Veritas operatives at protest planning meetings ahead of the inauguration. The operatives handed over the surreptitiously recorded videos to a D.C. detective, Gregory Pemberton, who would spend an entire year investigating the J-20 case. Defense counsel later discovered personal tweets sent out by Pemberton indicating his sympathy with the racist pro-Trump dignitary underbelly and used them to undermine his testimony at trial. According to a recent filing from former defendants, the withheld videos cut against the theory that the meeting was an exclusive, secretive meeting to plan unlawful conduct. The 60s area stereotype of violent leftists whispering clandestine plans was part of the narrative prosecutors tried to create, and they went as far as lying in open court to preserve it. This isn't the first time that authorities in D.C. have hunted for clues of a conspiracy post-riot. After the city's black residents rose up following the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, the feds wanted to know who, if anybody, had orchestrated the chaos and whether similar uprisings in more than 100 cities had been part of a revolutionary conspiracy to overthrow the white American system. Stokely Carmichael, then the leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, emerged as a primary suspect. After, shortly, King's murder, Carmichael told a radio host from Havana, Cuba, that it was crystal clear that the United States of America must fall in order for humanity to live, and we are going to have to give our lives for that cause. But no conspiracy indictment was ever filed against Carmichael or anybody else. The fact that conspiracy charges were filed for so many in the J-20 case illustrates how much prosecutorial aggression has advanced over the last half a century. Some in radical circles have called attention to the white privilege of the J-20 defendants, arguing that by virtue of their whiteness, or for the minority of non-white defendants, their proximity to the pool of privilege, defendants had access to platforms, sympathy, support networks, and resources that most low-income and non-white defendants lack, and that these advantages were hugely responsible for our success. I mostly agree. It is also true that the entire legal premise underpinning the felony charges filed against each of us was steeped in the U.S. century's long defense of white supremacy. The anti-rioting statute under which we were charged, which calls for a maximum sentence of 10 years, was passed in 1967 by Congress in the wake of black urban uprising in that decade. Prosecutors used it against black D.C. residents the following year. But the connection goes deeper. The unifying legal theory of our prosecution was that we engaged in a conspiracy and were therefore each equally liable for all property destruction or injury that occurred that day. This theory of liability stems from a mid-20th century Supreme Court decision in a moonshining and tax evasion case. But conspiracy law's modern origins extend to the founding of this country and beyond as a legal weapon of colonialism and counterinsurgency, primarily against black revolt. At the end of the 1600s, as the population of enslaved African America grew, the more encompassing category of whiteness ascended, writes Gerald Horn in Counter-Revolution of 1776, in which Horn argues that the Anglo-Saxon settlers' war for independence entrenched slavery. By 1680, one colonial legislature had drafted a bill to prevent Negroes' insurrection, and this was followed by a torrent of similar anti-conspiracy legislation in the colonies over the next several decades in response to planned and executed rebellions. Elite settlers threatened by the growing population of Africans saw the creation of pan-European solidarity in the colonies as necessary to guard against constant revolts. Key to the eventual supremacy of the concept of whiteness. Horn writes, was that it not be interrogated too hard, lest the loose threads of class hierarchy that this racial category otherwise obscured unravel and ruin the entire colonial project. This gets to the heart of the matter. In order for the colonies to overcome endless conspiracies to revolt by people they kidnapped, enslaved, exploited, and colonized, its ruling elite had to create their own conspiracy, the institutionalization of whiteness, in defense of its power. The Bill of Rights would later implicitly enshrine the three points of power in the new nation, including whiteness, property ownership, wealth, and cis-hetero maleness, consolidating ruling class power through the law. Writing for the Harvard Law Review nearly a century ago, Francis B. Sayer wrote that American courts often use conspiracy law as a cudgel, especially during times of reaction, to punish, as criminal, association for which the time being are unpopular or stir up prejudices of the social class in which the judges have, for the most part, been bred. It's more than just prejudice. Today, the U.S. elite reaffirms its power through law, war, trade, and politics daily in a coordinated effort to preserve the status quo in all its structural inequality. The extreme and concentrated power in its own kind of conspiracy, one that allows the state to prosecute others it considers illegal. There isn't enough room here to chronicle the ways conspiracy law has been used since the 17th century to criminalize associations of non-white people, laborers, immigrants, protesters, revolutionaries, and others, or to consider nuanced exceptions such as mafia prosecutions that rope police and politicians into criminal rackets. But fundamentally, the difference between a legitimate and illegitimate conspiracy comes down to power. It's ironic that some top Trump cronies involved in the J-20 conspiracy prosecution are themselves caught up in their own high-profile conspiracy cases, though not necessarily as defendants. For example, Roger Stone, that long-ago Nixon muckraker, and more recently a top campaign advisor to his friend Trump, sent far-right spies to inauguration protesters planning meetings as far back as December 2016. Stone was referenced in a July indictment against a dozen Russian intelligence military officers as a senior member of Trump's campaign in direct contact with Russian hackers targeting the 2016 election campaign. Another is Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the top official overseeing the J-20 conspiracy prosecution. In March of 2016, Sessions was beckoned in an email sent to Trump campaign official Rick Dearborn from Republican activist Paul Erickson, who wanted to arrange a meeting between Trump and Vladimir Putin. A criminal complaint unsealed in July claims Erickson was manipulated by a Russian operative named Maria Butina to gain access to top Republicans. In another twist, the J-20 defendants may have been saved by prosecutors out of the U.S. Attorney's Office turning their attention to Butina's conspiracy prosecution. To this day, neither Sessions nor any prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. have spoken publicly about J-20. While prosecutors don't often comment publicly on their cases, this could have been the perfect chance for this Justice Department to trumpet its law and order bona fides, which makes its silence striking. Instead, prosecutors showed their ass in court, just as the authoritarian Trump presidency in everything from the Russia meddling case to the overt embrace of white supremacy to the attacks on the press is showing the country's behind to the world right now. The power structure animating U.S. life are themselves the result of long-running conspiracies, and, to update Horn analysis, the American project is being intensely interrogated in this moment. History shows that when a state's ability to present itself as a stable force for social order wanes, illegal conspiracies begin to sprout. That's not what happened at the J20 protest, but it would be historical to think that it wouldn't happen somewhere else, or that a journalist wouldn't be there to cover it. The article contains a timeline titled "Yes Collusion." Tracing a conspiracy between the far right and the J20 prosecutors. Months before, D.C. police mass arrested people at Donald Trump's inauguration. Far right and white supremacist personalities were already coordinating a clampdown on anti-immigration protests. Evidence suggests that these parties, which included a top advisor and personal friend of Trump, worked closely with law enforcement to facilitate an unprecedented prosecution of protesters, journalists, and others over the next 18 months. Assembled here is a timeline of this collusion between the far right and state forces against the J20 defendants, based on public statements and media reports. November 9, 2016. Donald John Trump is elected president. November 11th, the Oath Keepers, a far white right paramilitary organization, begin to infiltrate anti-Trump protest meetings in Philadelphia, Baltimore, and possibly elsewhere. December 12th, alt-right media personality Jack Posobiec emails Trump presidential advisor Roger Stone a report after spying on inauguration protest planning meetings. December 21st, Stone appears on InfoWars to discuss protest meetings. January 8, 2017. Operatives from Project Veritas make secret recordings at a D.C. inauguration protest planning meeting, and the D.C. police are also present. January 11th. Oath Keepers turn over some of their recordings from inauguration protest planning meetings to the D.C. police. January 14th, a meeting about logistics at inauguration protest takes place in New York City. Project Veritas operative Allison Moss is present and records part of the meeting. Before January 20th, Project Veritas meets with D.C. Metropolitan Police, the FBI, and the Secret Service before Inauguration Day to discuss the protests. On January 20th, about 240 people are arrested during protest at Trump's inauguration and jailed for nearly 36 hours. February 4th, white nationalist Richard Spencer threatens on Twitter to dox all Inauguration Day arrestees after receiving their petitional information from D.C. police. February 21st, the U.S. Attorney's Office indicts 214 people for felony rioting at the inauguration. The charge carries a 10-year maximum sentence. April 27th, the U.S. Attorney's Office returns a superseding indictment which includes felony rioting, conspiracy, and destruction charges for all the defendants except Aaron Cantu. May 30th, Cantu is indicted for the same felonies as the rest of the 120 defendants. July 27th, Assistant U.S. Attorney Jennifer Kirchhoff tells a judge all defendants are equally liable for damage that occurred at the protests. August 22nd, the U.S. Department of Justice backs off its request for 1.3 million IP addresses of those who visited an anti-Trump protest website. November 15th, the first six 120 defendants go to trial, including photojournalist Alexei Wood. From November to December, U.S. prosecutors use video obtained from Project Veritas and the Oath Keepers as evidence at the first 120 trial. December 21st, The first six defendants go to trial or acquitted on all charges. January 19, 2018. Prosecutors drop charges against 129 defendants. Charges remain against Cantu and 58 others alleged as a part of a core group. May 16th, the second group of 120 defendants goes to trial with prosecutors using near-identical arguments as at the first trial. May 31st, a D.C. court sanctions prosecutors for misrepresenting the existence of more than 70 additional Project Veritas videos. June 11th, the trial for the second group of defendants ends in acquittals and mistrials. July 6th, prosecutors drop all charges against all remaining defendants. July 10th, alt-right media personality Mark Cernanovich encourages Twitter volunteers to support the Unmasking Antifa Act, which punishes wearing masks at raucous protest by up to 15 years in prison. Turning now to the indie food section, Munchies in Motion. Trumping the food trucks is so 2016. The now thing is mobile food on Instagram, and its name is The Dankery. In 2010, when Ian Burris was in ninth grade at Riverside High School, he started selling a homemade cold-cut sandwich to classmates in gym. The next summer, he launched a lawn mowing business. When he opened Shrimp Pond Pasta's boutique, an Instagram-based clothing store where he resold customized jerseys and limited edition sneakers that he ordered online. His next venture landed him on probation for marijuana possession in 2016. He was living in Wilmington after dropping out of Cape Fear Community College, but instead of losing his initiative, Burris moved back to Durham and opened late-night food delivery business, Shrimp and Pasta's Dankery, its name winking at his prior enterprise, from 9 p.m. to 3 a.m. each day. Burris cooks his munchie-friendly food in a new food truck, takes orders through Instagram, DMs, and deploys delivery drivers to Durham doors. The Dankery's menu is structured around a $7 dank tray, which comes with chicken or vegan tenders, wings, or a shrimp burger with a side of fries, homestyle, garlic parm, or bacon queso. Customers can choose from 18 different flavors to add to their entree, ranging from buffalo blue cheese sauce to lemon pepper dry rub. In Wilmington, I had given up on college soccer and was living with friends, Burris said. I would make them food all the time because I love cooking. Eventually, word spread, and people that I didn't live with started hitting me up for food as well. Though Burris had left the weed business behind, he still had entrepreneurial energy to burn. He got the Dankery started to his parents' garage with two fryers and bought at Bed Bath & Beyond. He marketed himself on Instagram with the handle at Shrimp and Pastry Dankery, posting menus and food photos. His network of high school friends paired with his established Instagram presence allowed him to quickly gain a loyal customer base. I learned about the Dankery because I went to high school with Ian. I ordered his food once and haven't stopped, Molly McCullough says. My friend and I always plan nights to order it, and we place orders as early as possible. So we're first in line. It's almost a ritual. McCullough's favorite Dankery item used to be the bacon queso fries, but now that she's a vegetarian, she opts for the soy tenders, which she finds just as satisfying. Word about the Dankery spread around Duke and the North Carolina Central University's campuses, providing Burris with a massive clientele of hungry college kids. Through his customers are usually young people craving tasty fried food after most restaurants have closed, he says that the demographic widens every day. Burris, now 21, bought a food truck in December of 2017, and he has hired a handful of employees. He doesn't use the truck for deliveries. He just wanted his own cooking space and pickup spot. He says he fulfills 60 to 70 orders a night, and he foresees a brick-and-mortar location in the future. Burris learned how to cook from his parents, but when it comes to running a business, cleaning, budgeting, managing other people, he's self-taught. He always hated having authority figures talk down to him, so his endeavors to treat his employees as equal. If I don't want someone scolding me, I don't think my employees would like that I do that to them either. Even when I'm frustrated, I try to talk to everybody calmly so we don't start panicking on the truck. In hindsight, Burris is glad he had to move back to Durham, and he takes pride in being a Durham business owner. I can't think of a better place to run the Dankery, he said. More people here are getting hip every day. All my clientele are really dope people. Durham is my city. I'm happy to see it grow. I feel like it's been evolving with me growing up as I have. One of his chefs, Stacy Silver, a model rapper and tailor, shares with Burris both a love of the Bull City and a certain bravado. I have big dreams in life, and I'm going to see those dreams come true no matter what. I will never resign from the Dankery, Silver says. Even if I have $500 million in the bank, I'm from Durham, and I'm going to come back sooner or later, and when I do, I will be on that truck. Burris utilizes Instagram stories to promote his project and offer words of wisdom. A typical story might start with a photo of Frank's Red Hot seasoning with the caption, "Ask about hot fries," and then transition into a series of videos in which Burris preaches business lessons that he has learned. I was never in a class where I was spoken to about potentially running my own business, so I had to figure it out for myself, he said. A lot of kids growing up thinking they're not going to be worth anything, but don't tell them that there's a whole lot of world, and I hope that I can be an example for that kind of a person. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.